Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Koh.
And welcome back to Your Health, Catherine.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
You know, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Aaron DiMartino, Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine Fellow at the Mayo Clinic, about who makes healthcare decisions on behalf of patients who can't. This is actually a really important issue for tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people across the country.
Absolutely. I think it's a topic that will affect someone at least at some point in their life, and yet we know very little about it in the public.
Yeah, that'll be shocking. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Speaking of shocking, our very first research that matters is shocking in a good sense, I think, and that's research about kind of an elusive goal, which is making blood, yes, I'm making new blood from a patient's own stem cells. Seems like we're on the cusp of something important.
Absolutely. So this study comes out of Boston Children's Hospital, and it was published in the journal Nature, where they were actually able to create these blood cells like you were talking about. So since a pluripotent stem cell that can become many different types of cells in the body was discovered, kind of this has been the holy grail in the quest for trying to figure out how to make blood cells.
I bet someone's going to be out there and make a movie out of this, because it sounds like they kind of knew for a while that they could make these kind of stem cells, as you call them, the pluripotent stem cells, but they couldn't quite go to the next step. And they had to then make these cells that have the signals to direct these cells to become more specialized cells and to become different types of blood cells. And then they had to kind of do modifications and have these regulatory factors that kind of, they call them transcription factors. I love the names here. And it pushed these cells to be more like real blood-forming states. And then they had to put these factors into a virus, and then that's used in some forms of gene therapy, which then transplanted, I'm getting kind of tired, into these cells, into mice. And then they can harvest these things from the mice.
You know, it's so amazing, first, that people before them were able to identify all of these different factors and chemical signals that lead towards making blood cells, and then to put it in the forward-playing motion to go from these stem cells and create blood cells. But it seems like they were able to get some out of these mice that they injected.
And I think the real benefit will be that people have genetic blood disorders, and there are lots of them, like people with different sorts of anemias, people who have all kinds of inherited disorders, as well as people who need blood products. Mm-hmm. They can actually potentially cure the genetic disorders and have an endless supply of blood. That's the promise. We're not in humans yet, but it sounds like this is a big step forward.
Definitely a big step.
We're excited by that. Let's talk about our next research that matters. That's something that's maybe less sexy, but maybe saves a lot of lives, and that is, were more cancers caught early on after the Obamacare regulations were put in place? What's this about, Catherine?
Yeah, so there was the study, Dr. Hahn looked at whether or not more people were diagnosed with early stage cancers compared to later stage cancers, so what they described as stage one cancer, for the core hitters, if you will, breast cancer, colon cancer, cervical cancer, and lung cancer. And they looked since the Affordable Care Act was implemented, and they found that the Affordable Care Act, since that time, about 1% more early cancers were detected. Now, 1% may not sound like a lot, but when you're talking about thousands of people, it's actually a pretty big step.
Yeah, probably millions of people across the country, because what happened under Obamacare is the screening for these sorts of cancers was what was called the essential health benefit. So all plans had to cover these. And certainly an increase in the screening for three out of the four of these by 1% translates into many cancers being caught earlier, which for lung cancer, it's one of the few things that really does make a difference. And for some of these other cancers, I think most people would be happier to have them caught earlier. The real question also is, this is not cause and effect. This was an observation. But there does raise this concerns that if this law is changed, if Obamacare is changed and another law takes its place and these essential health benefits are optional rather than mandatory, these gains may go backwards. I think if I were a listener, I'd be concerned.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, well, hopefully we won't have to find out. These essential benefits, I think, are critical for us keeping in place.
I thought this next research that matters was pretty interesting, where researchers have found two different plant-based chemicals that can be used as an alternative for contraceptives.
Yeah, these chemicals that they're studying were called Lupeol, L-U-P-E-O-L, and Pristimerin. These are chemicals that have properties of potentially maybe inhibiting the function of sperm. So it may limit the ability of sperm to be as effective, which could be a male contraceptive. What did they find?
So what they were looking at, these two chemicals, they derived from dandelion root and then this other plant called thunder god vine. And they've been used in traditional medicines in the past, but this was the first time that they were studied as potentially being used as an alternative to emergency contraceptive. Now, this is all still in very basic science research world and not ready for human consumption by any means. But essentially, these two chemicals function as what they term a molecular condom, in the sense that it doesn't do anything to hurt the sperm, but it just makes them less active.
Yeah, and I know some people would feel that that's interfering, but I think many people, perhaps a lot of men who haven't had choices for birth control, might like that this could be something very beneficial to them. And as you say, one of the problems has been that there's not something both safe and effective as a male contraceptive. Now, before everyone rushes out there and, you know, gets dandelion root and thunder god vine, also called thunder duke vine, and these are traditional Chinese medicine herbs, you should recognize that there are some potential side effects of these particular medicines. And that's, I think, one of the concerns. So, for instance, the thunder duke vine has been known to have safety problems related to really kind of important side effects. And a lot of places have adverse impacts on immune system functioning and immunosuppression. And so there are kind of warnings on this in routine use. So I think we don't know if this would be really safe. And then you can't really extract these yet. There's not an easy, inexpensive way to make them. So we're a long way away from being able to use these. But this was, again, National Academy of Sciences journal. It's a big journal.
Yeah. And if they need any additional dandelions, they could come to my yard. And I have a plethora for them.
You're going to be making a tea. I can see it now. A long line of men outside your house.
Yeah.
Well, what's our very last research that matters about gun laws? We're not shy from delving into things that some people might find controversial if we think it improves health.
Absolutely. So this was a new study from the University of Indianapolis that was published in the American Journal of Public Health. And what they looked at and found was that people who are living in states with weak gun laws, if you will, were more than twice as likely to be fatally shot by law enforcement compared to those who had strong gun laws.
This was published in the American Journal of Public Health, and it was called Firearm Legislation and Fatal Police Shootings in the United States. And looking at between January and October of 2015 and 2016 at 1,800 fatal police shootings, and looking at the association between the state's gun laws and the risk of a fatal shooting, and then accounting for gun ownership, violent crime, and other things, showing again, as you just said, those with weak gun laws had an increased risk of being fatally shot. Now, this is not causal. This is an observation. And I can see that there could be lots of problems looking at this research, like lots of reasons why there could be fatal shootings that are not measured by things they looked at.
Certainly a lot of confounding factors and variables to take in, that some of the answers we may never know why things occurred.
Yeah. And we also don't know what's happening with the law enforcement in these states. It certainly would suggest, though, however, if it were true that there would be less fatal police shootings if more states had stronger gun laws, that would be the positive side here, which would be a great thing, a win-win for lots of people.
Absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Catherine. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Aaron DeMartino, pulmonary and critical care medicine fellow at the Mayo Clinic, about who makes healthcare decisions on behalf of a patient who can't. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Cove. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Coe. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we're talking with Dr. Aaron DeMartino, Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine Fellow at the Mayo Clinic, about a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine she wrote about who makes healthcare decisions on behalf of a patient who cannot.
Welcome, Dr. DeMartino. We're so excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be with you.
One of the things I think we're really interested in, obviously the topic of healthcare decision-making for people who cannot for so many different reasons, but I think we'd like to know a little bit more about you and your background. How did you get interested in medical school, doing a subspecialty in critical care medicine, and also ethics?
Well, I think my interest in medical ethics may stem from my background, which was I was an art history and English major in college and always kind of looked at the more human side of medicine. I'm maybe not as natural a scientist as a lot of my classmates were, and was very drawn to the interpersonal conversations and connections that are made when somebody is sick, and particularly when somebody is very, very sick and ends up in the intensive care unit. And I became more and more interested in the way that doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists interact with family members of our patients, because often it's not just a doctor-patient relationship like it might be in, say, a medical clinic setting, because there are a lot of different voices who come to the bedside of a critically ill patient, and often one voice that we don't hear is that of the patient.
Thank you so much for that overview of kind of your experience thus far, and certainly, you know, having gone through medical school as well, oftentimes as a medical student, the most you can do is sort of observe some of those interactions between physicians and non-physician providers. Do you have a particular story in mind that really sort of sparked your interest to take this a step further into medical decision-making and also providing the voice for the patient?
Probably the case that inspired me was one of a young person who had been very healthy up until essentially the moment that he wasn't healthy. And really, his family and friends had no forewarning that his health was about to take a turn for the worse. And he ended up, in the course of several days that I knew him in the hospital, deteriorating from a person who could make his own decisions to very quickly a person who was completely dependent on life-sustaining therapies. He was on a mechanical ventilator, and he was sedated. He was on blood pressure medicines to keep his blood pressure high enough to support the rest of the organs in his body. He was essentially in multiple organ failure. And having known his family from the moment he walked through the door of the hospital and kind of walked through this journey with them while I was a third-year medical student and trying to support them as they came, you know, through this journey from being just mom and dad to all of a sudden also having to make these really critical decisions for him and assume that mantle of burden and responsibility making his decisions, medical decisions for him, really made a lasting impact on me and was my first exposure to those types of situations in the medical field and sparked an interest moving forward.
When we think about a term that you talk about, decisional incapacity, what does that term mean, and how many people does this affect who maybe meet that type of term in the United States?
So the term decisional incapacity means that a person at a given moment in time doesn't have the ability to kind of take in information, medical information about his or her condition and think about it in a way that they're able to come to a decision and be able to explain that decision. To have decisional capacity doesn't mean that you are going to end up making the same decision or judgment as your doctor, meaning that you don't have to always agree with what your doctor recommends in order to demonstrate that you have decisional capacity. And something else that's really tough, even for a lot of people in the medical field to understand, is that you might have decisional capacity to make certain types of decisions, simple decisions, like you have the decisional capacity to go along with treatment recommendations, like taking the pills that your nurse brings into the hospital room in the morning and telling us who you would want to make your medical decisions for you if you weren't able to make your own medical decisions. But at the same time, you might not have so much ability, thinking ability, that you would be able to consent to a very complicated surgery or procedure or something like that. So it's a tough concept, I think, even for physicians, and it's one that pretty routinely ends up requiring an expert to come in and help determine, maybe a psychiatrist or an ethics consult team to help us determine sometimes if somebody has enough mental ability to make their own decisions in these really kind of critical cases.
Is this something where an advance directive might come into play? And if it is, if you could walk through our listeners what an advance directive is and if it's something that they might consider.
Sure. Yes, it's absolutely something where an advance directive can come into play. An advance directive is a legal document. So each state has an advance directive and a group of laws that kind of govern what should be included in an advance directive. To take a step back, advance directive is kind of an umbrella term for two terms that your listeners may also be familiar with: a power of attorney, in this case, a power of attorney for healthcare. So somebody that you decide in advance that you're going to give authorization or power to in the event that you can't make your own decisions. But an advance directive can also cover what's known commonly as a living will. And a living will is more of a person sitting down and thinking through some potential treatments, treatment decisions, or therapies that they may be confronted with in years to come, and making some decisions about what their preferences would be if they, say, were in a situation where they were not ever going to regain consciousness or they were close to death. Would they want to be on a ventilator for the last days of their life? Or would they want to receive CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation? Those types of things are often covered in a living will. And some living wills also talk about the things that you do want, not just setting limitations. So they might say that you do want therapies that are directed toward your comfort, and you want to make sure that you are clean and surrounded by family members and listening to music that you like and things like that. So they can have both kind of positive requests and negative requests.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue this really fascinating conversation with Dr. Aaron DiMartino, pulmonary and critical care medicine fellow at the Mayo Clinic, about who makes healthcare decisions on behalf of patients who cannot. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. We've been talking with Dr. Aaron DiMartino, pulmonary and critical care medicine fellow at the Mayo Clinic, about who makes healthcare decisions on behalf of patients who can't. And Dr. DiMartino, I remember reading a few years ago that patients, after they pass, if the surrogate really doesn't know really their full wishes, that advanced care directive, they're only 50-50 at kind of getting it right. How do we really improve upon it? Because those advanced care directives also may change as people move along in their lives.
I think you raise a really important point, and the point that I like to emphasize with patients, but also even just my own friends and family, is the importance of the conversation. So it's not just about completing an advance directive and having a, say, notarized document, if that's what your state requires for documentation. It's more important, I think, to have sat down around the dining room table at some point with your family members and talked about what's important to you and what your priorities are, how you feel about healthcare, and how you might like your final days to be if you were very sick. What would be an acceptable quality of life to you, and what would be kind of too much, and when you would really just want your family members to allow you to die a natural death. And I also think that it's important to not just have somebody who, say, has a chronic disease under the spotlight and be interrogated by their whole family, but also to shift that attention to every member of the family who's sitting around the table. Because unfortunately, the more I work in this field, the more I realize the unpredictability of who might get sick and the importance of having conversation on a fairly regular basis, because you're right that as people may receive a new diagnosis or age, their priorities may shift in time, and what might have been important to somebody at 35 may not be as important at 75.
Certainly, I can definitely see the importance of the conversation. Growing up, my mom actually, she's still alive and well and doesn't have any chronic medical conditions, but has shared her what her wishes would be in the event that she were unable to make decisions for herself. And as a young person growing up, a conversation that's difficult to hear and kind of think about what would happen in that situation. But now, like you, kind of as I go through the medical field, I just see the importance and sort of am very thankful that we've had those conversations. But you and your co-authors mentioned that only a small percentage of the population actually has advance directives, which are the written documents, but who knows how many, either fewer or more, have had these conversations. Why exactly do you think that is, and what can we do to try and help improve these numbers?
Well, I think you've hit on an important point with your own story, and I can relate to that point, which is that it feels uncomfortable to talk about this. And even when you do it every day at work, it's still actually pretty uncomfortable when you bring it home to your own family and talk about it. And so I think a lot of it is that it's just a challenging topic, and nobody really wants to think about these things very much. I think what's important is to normalize it, and that we don't necessarily have to have a decision for every possible situation that might confront us down the road. What's much more important is understanding kind of the overarching thoughts and values of an individual than their specific thoughts about whether or not they would want to go on a ventilator, and if they wanted to be on a ventilator, for how long, and whether or not they would be willing to have a feeding tube, or some of those very specific questions. If somebody has a strong opinion about that, then it's good for us to know as doctors. But what's much more important for us to know is that the person who's making the decision, so the alternate decision maker, that they have a good sense of what their family member or loved one prioritizes in life and what's most important to them, so that we can help guide them through the much more specific situation that they're confronting at the moment that we meet them, say, in an intensive care unit.
You know, you are describing a situation that really is the heart of the doctor-patient relationship. But in your New England Journal of Medicine article, you really also delve into the legal realm in which a lot of these decisions rest. You did a 50-state analysis of these decision-making legislative rules. What did you discover that was either surprising, reassuring, or worrisome?
Well, one thing that was interesting, I think the most surprising thing to me as somebody who hadn't spent much time looking at the law or legal literature before, was how diverse different states' approaches were to the same types of clinical situations. And even within a given state, they may have different ways of kind of referring to the same decision maker or the same situation. They may use different terminology even within one statute. So I found it pretty amazing and overwhelming and frankly dizzying how much diversity there was, or how heterogeneous all these laws were, as you think about going from one state to another to another. And you think also about the fact that many of our healthcare systems have hospitals and clinics in different states. A lot of doctors hold medical licenses in different states, and a lot of patients cross a state border either intentionally or they're on vacation, and unintentionally they end up in a healthcare system in another state. And so they may be from one state but receiving care in another. And just to think about the fact that the way in which they're cared for and decisions are made for them when they're at their most vulnerable may change depending on, you know, being 10 miles away from home but across state lines, was pretty amazing to me and something that I wasn't very aware of. And I was fairly certain that the general physician population wasn't aware of, never mind the rest of us Americans.
You certainly bring up a good point that it does seem to vary so much. What are some tips that you could provide for our listeners, for those who are wanting to pursue either assigning a surrogate decision maker or putting it down in writing in the form of a living will or advanced directive or power of attorney?
Well, one thing that would be really, I think, helpful is if your listeners were interested, just to have a sense of what the law is in your state, so that you have a sense, say you don't have a legal document, of what happens, what the laws are in your state that are kind of the safety net for those of us who don't have advanced directives, which is about 4 in 5 American adults doesn't have an advanced directive today. And so knowing what happens in terms of decision making in your own state may be a motivator, to be honest, to go ahead and complete at least a durable power of attorney. So where you give authority to somebody to take over decision making when you're unable to make decisions, and at least telling that person that you have done so. Sometimes we have patients in the intensive care unit who have completed a durable power of attorney for healthcare. It's scanned into our medical chart. We call the, say, eldest son or somebody who is the person designated through that durable power of attorney, and it's the first time they ever found out that they had been named the durable power of attorney, and it's in the middle of a crisis. So not only completing the paperwork, but also having the courtesy to let your family member know that they are the chosen one and have a conversation about what's important.
That would be a difficult, a lot of responsibility. You know, we have about a minute left. I wonder if you can just briefly answer two quick questions. One, what's the next research gap that you want to address? And two, what's a final thought you would leave our listeners with?
The next steps in terms of our research, we're looking at the ways that states, different states, deal with types of life-sustaining therapies and which life-sustaining therapies are mentioned in the law, like feeding tubes come up in the law, but say defibrillators, which a lot of Americans have, don't tend to come up in the law very often. We're looking at also the ways in which the law tries to govern the doctor-patient relationship and the doctor's role in decision-making for people who can't make their own decisions. In terms of a final thought, I would say it's just a gift to your family to have thought about this a little bit for yourself and also to have communicated that to your family. It doesn't have to be a long, drawn out, painful conversation. And to do it over dinner or a meal, I think, has worked well for me. it's just so important to have done that. I really truly feel that the families that we see in the intensive care unit who have the benefit of having had one of these conversations are so much more at peace with whether things go well or they don't go well for their loved ones. It just makes it easier when the times are really tough.
Well, we certainly appreciate you bringing the conversation to our listeners who indeed may bring it in front of their healthcare providers and family members. That's a real blessing. Thank you for doing your research and being a guest today on Your Health.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Aaron DiMartino, pulmonary and critical care medicine fellow at Mayo Clinic, about who makes healthcare decisions on behalf of patients who can't. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call section of our show today, Catherine and I are going to answer our listeners' questions and concerns. And Catherine, they can send any question they have to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll be happy to try to answer it on the show. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call.
My 6-year-old son is prone to wetting the bed. It hasn't lessened really as he's gotten older. Is there anything we can do, or are there any medical conditions we should be talking about with his pediatrician?
Certainly, a tough problem to have impacting probably the child, the family, everyone who needs to wake up when this happens throughout the course of the night, not to mention laundry that has to be done. But certainly something to discuss with the pediatrician. First, I'd like to know if they have had any trials of things in the past, so their medicines as well as behavioral training modification items that people can use nowadays.
And even looking to see, are there causes for going on that haven't been looked into? Is the child moderately or significantly overweight and maybe have obstructive sleep apnea? Does the child have problems with their bowels in addition to their bladders, with constipation? Have they had any signs of a urinary tract infection or other things going on? Because we shouldn't assume that there's nothing going on.
Yeah, absolutely, which is why would be important to talk to either your pediatrician or your family doctor.
One of the other things I would also recommend considering and talking when you talk with your provider is that this may be normal. By age 5 years, it's still 16% of children might have some bedwetting. And at age 10 years, it could be 5%. By age 15 years, it's 1% to 2%. Now, these are difficult things, but that's the spontaneous rate of resolution. So for most children, as they get older, it will start getting better. A reassurance I would want to know if I was a parent.
Definitely.
Well, thank you for your question. Laura, what's our very next House Call?
Whenever I call my doctor and leave a message, her nurse practitioner is the one who returns the call. The nurse practitioner is wonderful, but sometimes I'd really rather talk to my doctor. Is there anything I can do to connect with her personally more often?
I think one of the first things is find out, is there a regular time that the doctor returns their calls? I have a lot of my patients who think that I'm kind of always there, always returning phone calls, versus I tend to return my phone calls between 5 and 6 o'clock at night. That's kind of a standard time. And if you're available, I can oftentimes talk with you at that time.
Yeah, definitely. And something else to consider is your doctor, do they have other clinical obligations or responsibilities? They may be at the hospital when you're trying to reach them and not necessarily always in clinic. So certainly asking them, like you said, if there's a time that might be best. Sometimes now with the new electronic health record, there may be ways that you could potentially email your doctor and see if you could get communication that way.
And part of it depends on how quickly the expectation, again, for a callback is. But there's absolutely no reason why you can't speak with your doctor. On the other hand, if it's an issue that can be taken care of by the nurse, or in this case, a nurse practitioner who has very similar training to many doctors, then that seems like a good thing. Because, like, you know, if you need a refill on a medication, for instance, or you want a copy of your lab test, you may not need to speak to your doctor for that.
And certainly, if you're ever concerned that you might be having an emergency, then I would try alternative modes of getting in contact with anyone in the healthcare profession or seek out care, either walk-in clinic, urgent care, or the emergency room.
But I would encourage you, next time you see your doctor, talk with her about kind of that expectation and find out what's going on. Like, like you said, Catherine, a lot of times it's just maybe a not matching expectations with possibilities, but you could certainly get a lot closer, and that would make for a better relationship.
Mm-hmm.
What's our very next house call, Laura?
I was diagnosed with diabetes several years ago and have been on medication since then. Recently, my A1C level was high. My doctor gave me the choice of losing weight or taking a second medication. He also made a referral to a nutritionist. Over the last month, I've lost 6 pounds. My blood sugars have come down from 215 to 165. I just wanted to say thank you and share this with others.
Hey, if
that's
you have
impressive.
A bell, we need a bell here to ring when we hear some really, really good news here. But we should also explain what is the patient talking about? Their A1C.
Yeah, so the A1C is a 3-month average of the blood sugars in someone's body. Essentially, red blood cells are around for about 120 days and collect sugar as they pass through your body. And so we're able to take that sample and look and see the average blood sugars someone has had over the last 3 months.
It can be pretty sensitive to things, particularly for people who are overweight, which is the number one cause of diabetes, to losing weight. If a person weighed 160 pounds and they really needed to get down to 140 pounds to reach their ideal body weight, a lot of times a 5% loss of that body weight can make a huge difference. Well, 5% of 160 pounds is about 8 pounds, and here you've already lost 6 pounds. So that's actually a major significant improvement.
Definitely, and I think partnering with the resources that are available. So in this case, getting a nutrition referral, maybe getting established with an exercise program, all of these things would be good for their health.
Well, thank you for that question, and we hope you keep going in that direction. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I recently had a pap smear, and the results came back as unsatisfactory. My doctor recommended repeating the test in 6 months because he said I was low risk and he wasn't concerned. Should I get another opinion?
Well, we'll give you some information, and we believe probably your doctor is probably on the right track, though we might have slightly different thoughts on this. Second off, I'm just saying I'm glad you've actually raising this question, because you know what? You would think this pap smear is like definitive, but sometimes it can't really tell so easy, and that's this unsatisfactory. You can't really tell.
There's a society that creates actually an algorithm to help guide providers as to what to do with normal or abnormal pap smear results.
Or ones that are kind of right in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. So lots of things kind of factor into that, particularly age. Usually 30 is where they decide one way or another.
Because the risk of younger would be higher. But as you get older, perhaps it may be a little less.
And then also HPV status, which stands for the human papillomavirus, which we now know has been associated with cervical cancer risk. And so tend to be a little bit more cautious in people who are HPV positive.
So this person was over the age of 30 and was HPV negative, so kind of a lower risk. What does the algorithm suggest?
So it suggests to repeat the cytology, which is a fancy word for looking at the cells in a liquid base.
Oh, the pap smear.
The pap smear, yep, exactly, in about 2 to 4 months.
So your doctor's probably on target here, said 6 months, and perhaps there's some reason that it wanted it delayed a little bit. I would just talk to your doctor, ask him if it could be done in 4 months or 3 months. It sounds like you're pretty low risk, particularly if you've had normal ones for quite a while. But great question. It doesn't mean that you're really at large risk. That's the main thing. And just rechecking again to get a satisfactory. No one likes to be unsatisfactory. Well, that'll conclude the house calls. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. You can send any questions or stories at yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can actually visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or search for our health app, Your Health in One Word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, Dr. Catherine Koh for our guest co-hosting today, and our guest today, Dr. Aaron DiMartino. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Catherine Koh.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.